You could be skeptical. You should be skeptical, but don't be cynical. And, reach out to all sides. Talk to all the people on a major issue to understand and represent as fairly and completely what it is that they're saying and what they say they believe.
Today, I talked to someone who's working to ensure that the next generation of investigative journalists have all the skills and tools they need to speak truth to power in the service of democracy. I'm Michael O'Connell. This is It's All Journalism. Ted Brightus is a former investigative journalist who led the Associated Press's Pulitzer Prize-winning team before joining the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications as a senior lecturer. He recently wrote an article examining the state of journalism in 2024 and the need for investigative reporting in talk media. And he's here to talk about that as well as other things. Ted, welcome to the It's All Journalism podcast.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So I like to find out a little bit about how my guests got into journalism. So when did you first decide that you wanted to be a journalist?
Crazy, crazy young. So funny backstory. I was the son of a Vietnam veteran in South Florida. He was a kind of a famous football player, national championship, played in college. And he went to Vietnam as a, as a young man, as a second lieutenant, and very quickly was mortally wounded on the battlefield.
Oh, wow.
And lost both legs and his right arm. But he survived and had a really impressive run. He counseled veterans. I mean, he came back, he got a job with the Coast Guard as a civil engineer. He competed in the Paralympics for the United States team twice as a distance wheelchair racer with one arm. He was a scuba diver. I mean, all these things. And so we had all these journalists constantly coming to the house, write these glowing pieces about, how great he was. And I love the fact that he was this revered figure. And I thought, it's pretty cool that these reporters are able to do this and talk to these really impressive people. And so it really sparked an interest in journalism. And so in high school, I started to focus on journalism. I went to the University of Missouri, which was at the time the oldest and the top journalism school in the country. Loved it. Joined AP immediately after I graduated, kind of bounced around the Midwest and the Southwest with AP for about a decade. And then I went to Washington and I spent the last 20 years of my professional journalism career in Washington for the Associated Press and the Wall Street Journal.
Wow. Wow. That's a pretty amazing career. I feel I need to ask, did you ever interview your father?
Well, of course, I talked to my father, and I think the thing I liked the most about what I wrote about my father was his eulogy, his obituary. When he died in 2013, he died from cancer. He went very quickly. I was able to bring back all of those conversations that we had had about why he did what he did and how he managed to persevere and just was such an impressive guy. And then right after his death, we were invited down. The Coast Guard actually named part of its facility in Miami after my dad.
Oh, wow.
So it was terrific.
Yeah. I wrote the obituary for my parents or their obituaries as well as my siblings. I don't know. I mean, you're a journalist. I guess, from my perspective, it was kind of like, I just felt like it was something I needed to do. And I had a perspective that was different. And provided I got my facts right, because strangely, the things that you would normally put it in an obituary, some of those things aren't necessarily at your fingertips. That you live with somebody, and anyway, this is not what we chose to talk about. So, to pick a place to start with, what do you see as the state of journalism in 2024?
Financially, we can't ignore the elephant in the room. The industry is really still struggling to figure out what business models work for the digital age. For a decade and more ago, we gave away our product online, and we've trained readers and viewers and listeners to believe that, that's what it's worth, that it's free and that it's a commodity. And so, we're seeing the shutdown of the Messenger, this new newsroom that had started up. We saw massive layoffs at the LA Times. We saw layoffs at the Wall Street Journal, which were really especially frustrating to me because that newspaper is profitable. I mean, it was actually making money and they still laid off journalists. I think journalistically, a lot of newsrooms are still doing some amazing, amazing work under really difficult conditions. There's fewer reporters and editors working these days, but they're still working really hard to do what's right and report accurately and ethically. Competition is as fierce as ever for scoops and clicks and eyeballs. And then who we're covering, right? The elected officials and the public figures that we write about, they're getting better and better at operating in the shadows when they want to. Just last week, we revealed that a big government agency here in Florida had been hacked and they were holding the files for ransom. And the office that's paid to respond to reporters' questions was not answering the questions from my student journalists. So we started contacting, higher level officials, and some of them talked to us. And then the public affairs officer called back and started screaming about how unprofessional it was to try to go around her. It was like, well, answer our questions. And she gave us a two-sentence statement that really didn't say much, and then refused to answer any more questions about the fact that this public agency that's very, very important in Florida had been hacked. So, these people hire PR experts and they spin what they're doing on social media and in TV interviews. It sows confusion and it challenges the credibility of the reporters who are, writing and broadcasting news that they don't want to be reported.
Do you think that's wildly different than, maybe 20, 30 years ago in journalism?
I think they're getting more sophisticated at it. I think that's the challenge. We saw prior to Trump, we saw politicians getting better and better at convincing their voting bases that reporters can't be trusted, that we're the enemy of the people. That's just not true. I mean, we're such an important part of democracy, a watchdog on all the parts of government. And yeah, do we make mistakes? Sometimes, and sometimes too often. Sometimes they're really dumb mistakes that we make. But when we do, our own rules say that we correct them quickly and transparently and admit, when we screw up. And there are a lot of reporters and outsiders keeping watch over what we report and making sure that it's honest and accurate. But they're getting better at this. The sophistication of the people that we cover has ramped up. They're learning their lessons.
The tools that we have at our disposal, they have at their disposal. The things that are making us do our jobs better also benefit them in some ways. And just to make a comment about your experience with the public information officer, I'm not really surprised. That's been my experience always. I was working at a radio station in DC during the Obama administration, and to show that this is not one side or the other, they were very controlling of the message. You couldn't find anybody who would talk on the record about anything. But you see that elsewhere. But when good journalism happens, people do notice it. That's been my experience. So what classes are you teaching?
I teach political journalism. I teach investigative journalism. I teach breaking news, how to cover news on deadline very quickly and still maintain that level of accuracy. And I teach one of my favorite classes. I teach a public records class. It's a foundational course. It's a big lecture size class. I've got 50 or 80 students in there every semester. It's where to go find credible, accurate information so that you don't have to wait for the public affairs officer to call you back, because she's probably not going to call you back. So go find the information yourself. And it's how to look up court records, how to look up police records, how to look up, corporate SEC registration files, how to pull property records, voter registration records. I mean, it's a whole gamut of official sourced credible documents and where to go find it and how to find it quickly and cheaply and how to find the people that you can talk to quickly on deadline. That's really important because, like you said, the bureaucrats and the politicians, they sometimes just won't talk to us. They refuse to answer our questions or they just sort of lie without shame. So.
Yeah, and they manipulate the information that they're giving you. There's somebody that is a source for a lot of people in this area politically, and he has his own social media account, but then he works for elected officials and sends out their social media. So sometimes he's retweeting his own tweets from a different account. Little things like that, and if people find out, then it's like, well, what do I trust? How can I trust? And that's why, sometimes you show up somewhere and it's a journalist and say, oh, well, why should I trust you? You never get it right, which is when you need to show them that actually you care about it and that you're going to do that. What are the students like now? I mean, how do they compare to students, 10, 20 years ago, do you think?
They're terrific. They want the world to be a better place. They want to preserve democracy. They want to tell interesting stories about interesting audiences. They care deeply about what's right and what's wrong, and they want to hold accountable the people in power. and the people who make decisions. I think that the challenge we have is when you're dealing with 20 and 22 year olds, sometimes they come in with a mindset of everything is black and white. And we have to sort of caution them that public policy issues are incredibly complicated. And there's a lot of nuance and there's a lot of gray. And, you know, sometimes it is black and white. You know, racism is bad. That's inarguable. But understanding the motivations of politicians, you can't be cynical. You could be skeptical. You should be skeptical, but don't be cynical. You know, reach out to all sides. You know, talk to all the people on a major issue to understand and represent as fairly and completely what it is that they're saying and what they say they believe. But no, they're terrific. I mean, they're smart, they're sharp. And the students that I've taught now in 5 years of doing this at a major college of journalism, you know, they're off at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Associated Press, Miami Herald. They're landing jobs and doing incredible work right out of the gate.
What are the skills you think that best suit these students for the way journalism is being run now?
Well, you know, they're digital natives, and so that helps a lot. You know, the same changing landscape that has affected how we deliver news and how we pay for news and how we pay for reporters is also providing some really cool new opportunities in the journalism field. So, you know, we're hiring journalists who don't write articles, they write newsletters to send to subscribers every morning so that you get the news on your phone. We're training experts in packaging our journalism for social media platforms so that we can reach more people and new audiences at different times and different kind of storytelling techniques. Traditional print newsrooms, the New York Times and the Washington Post, the Miami Herald, I mean, they're doing terrific video reporting. That's opened up a whole new avenue. And then data experts and AI programmers are helping to build, you know, new tools to let, you know, fewer journalists in newsrooms do more and do it more efficiently without compromising the accuracy of our reporting. Journalists look at complicated engagement metrics to measure what readers are most interested in so we can give audience, you know, what they want. And as college journalism professors, you know, we're having to teach all these new skills, plus the old stuff, right? Teach reporting, how to interview people, how to track people down, how to find information, how to write a compelling story, and more. So they've got these skills, we're honing them, and we're making sure that over and over and over, it's, you know, get it first, but first get it right. Operate with ethics, operate with honesty, operate with integrity.
We're 6 or 7 months away from a presidential election, and you've covered in recent years presidential elections. How do you think that the reporting of the election so far has been? Just what's been your observation?
Yeah, I've covered presidential elections. You know, I ran the AP's investigative team for 11 years. You know, I'm the reporter that found Hillary Clinton's email server in her basement.
You're to blame.
I'm also I also led the team of reporters that put Trump's campaign chairman at the time in prison for illegal foreign lobbying. And I was the AP election caller that was first to project Trump winning the presidency in 2016. So yeah, I've been around, I've done this kind of reporting. You know, I'm still frustrated at the emphasis on reporting the results of national election polls and surveys about the candidates. I get the value of that, but that's not how elections work in the United States. And in most cases, the winner of each state election, of course, earns all the electoral college votes. So it's much more important, but it's also much more expensive to do state by state polling, even if you're just focusing on the battleground states. So most news organizations don't do that. They just do the national polling. But I don't care what voters across the U.S. in the aggregate care about Biden versus Trump. I care about what voters in Ohio care versus what voters in Pennsylvania care, what voters in Colorado and Arizona and Florida care. That's what matters. That's what's going to tilt the election. I think we need to report what candidates are saying on the trail. We need to be more than just transcriptionists. We can't just sort of, you know, quote them accurately. We need to compare what they're saying with what they're doing or what they have done. And then I think we need to do a much better job understanding the minds of voters on all sides, understand why people support Trump, why people support Biden, why people are turned off by Biden or turned off by Trump. We don't talk to voters nearly enough.
You mentioned the 2016 election. I remember after that, there was a lot of hand-wringing in newsrooms about you know, maybe with Trump, we were just, you know, as you said, transcribing. We were just allowing, you know, we were giving them a platform because they were saying stuff that other candidates hadn't said before, in a way maybe that they hadn't said before. And so just on a, you know, a bold face one look, it's like, oh, wow, this is intriguing. And this is, you know, people want to hear what the next thing is going to say. But what ends up happening is that kind of shapes the message that you're putting out there. If you're not, you know, questioning or doing any reporting around it.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. You know, I think there's too much emphasis on the name calling and the sort of, you know, low hanging fruit. We really need to help voters understand how some of the policies that are being proposed or described by candidates are actually going to affect their lives. You know, what has been done in the past, what works, what is plainly not working, and don't let anybody off the hook.
And the other thing about this, I know you talk about, you know, 50 different elections, is because of what's happened over the last couple of decades in our industry, as large dailies, as local newspapers have folded or laid off significant portions of their staff, a lot of the traditional type of reporting we do around politics, either they don't have the resources or reach to really, you know, make a difference. And that's always concerning. What do you think about, like, I know in Virginia, have you heard of the Virginia Public Access Project?
Yeah, so I'm familiar with these types of programs to collaborate, to advance more community journalism, more local journalism. When I came to the University of Florida from AP, one of the first things I did was I started a news service that my students actually report and write articles. We cover the governor, we cover the state legislature, we send them up to the Capitol. We cover state courts, we cover the Supreme Court here in Florida. And so you've got students operating under the supervision of very, very experienced journalists with, you know, 3 decades of experience, writing really important stories. And then we give those stories for free to over 100 newsrooms around Florida and say, you can republish these. It gives the students some exposure and some branding. It gives the readers across Florida an additional outlet, an additional source of credible, trusted journalism. And it helps the news organizations because they've got really high quality free content to distribute. And we're seeing those types of collaborations increasingly. You know, journalism is still a very competitive industry. And, you know, you try to scoop your competitor across town by even a few minutes. But sometimes you got to sit down and work together because we don't have the resources that we used to have. And I think these are terrific collaborations. I judge a lot of journalism competitions every year, the $25,000 Collier Prize here at the University of Florida for state government reporting, judge the Katherine Graham Award by the White House Correspondents Association for courageous news gathering, and others. And there's just really terrific work being done across the country. And we know what happened during the law enforcement response during the mass school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, because of reporters. And it was the Texas Tribune teamed up with Frontline and teamed up with ProPublica, and all three news organizations worked collaboratively to tell a really important accountability story. And we've seen that happening in every state. So, you know, we teamed up here in Florida with a local newspaper to cover some horrible things that were happening at one of the biggest hospitals here in Florida. And we had student journalists partnering with professional journalists working at this newspaper because we were making some progress on our own, but together we were able to do a lot more. So I think that's definitely a model that's going to go forward.
Talking about politics, there was a lot of talk about, you know, the last couple of elections about like false equivalency, this idea that, you know, well, if A says something, then I have to report whatever B says as sort of a, this is our ethical, you know, way of balancing things. But the criticism was that a lot of the things that maybe B said were not truthful, or they, you know, as we've been talking about, sometimes the truth is manipulated. How do you teach your students to sort of, you know, mentally maneuver that?
Yeah, incredibly difficult question. This is a question that, you know, the top editors with decades of experience at the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, CNN are wrestling with. And what we tell our students is, understand what the sides are saying, look for evidence whether that is true or whether there is additional context that needs to be explained to voters and readers so that they can understand what a candidate is saying is true or not. You know, we call it whataboutism. You know, well, what about the other guy? Okay, that doesn't diminish what we're focusing on right now about what you have done. And yeah, we'll come back and explore what happened 2 years ago in another camp. But meanwhile, we're going to pay attention to this because this is current, this is relevant, this is salient to the moment. These editorial judgments, they are incredibly important. We need to maintain the trust of readers. And we've got readers across the political spectrum, and they've just been trained by these elected officials and these bureaucrats to watch for and be primed to look for any perceptions of bias. And our bias, honestly, I mean, I've been doing this for decades. Our bias is for the truth. We want to tell what is factually happening and what people are actually saying and what they're doing, and holding them accountable for that.
And one of the things, again, this is all part of the same conversation, that sometimes your sources, you ask them a question, you go there, I need to get this information, this is the person that's going to answer me. And often they're not going to answer that question. They will try to take the question in a different way or give you a different answer for the question they want to be asked. And it's just like a type of manipulation, clearly, you know, an avoidance. And so do you report that?
Yeah, we do. I mean, you know, if you go to the subject of your reporting and you say, I've got these five questions, and the subject says, I'm not going to answer those, or all the subject does is release a sort of a statement that isn't really directly, you know, addressing what it is that you're asking, I think you say, decline to answer these five questions, but, you know, in a statement provided, you know, said this. And if you need to parse the statement to give readers the context or the understanding, I think that's important too. We have to tell students, like, don't just blindly accept what they're handing out. Try to get to the bottom of this and ask the questions on video or ask the questions on audio so that readers can hear the disassembling and the avoidance. Government is getting better and better at managing reporters. We teach students too, we're real heavy emphasis on accountability journalism and also on public records. So if they're not going to answer the question, well, let's demand the records that would provide those answers. Yeah, it may take longer. It may take a few weeks, maybe even a few months before we can compel the government to turn over those inside documents, but that's going to be credible. And they understand that because they're passing new laws and new rules that weaken transparency, you know, and give them more time to delay the release of records and new exemptions to allow them to withhold that kind of stuff. They understand that that's one of the ways that we hold them accountable.
Yeah. I try to take advantage of every opportunity I can to educate a reader about our processes. Sometimes I feel that if a person just understood why I'm reporting something a particular way, then maybe they would view the story very differently. And some of that stuff's easy to do. Some of it's really hard to do.
We call it media literacy, right? People don't understand why we do what we do and how we do it. And we really, you know, in order to regain some of the trustworthiness that we've lost, I think we need to be much more fulsome about being open and writing into the stories. You know, this is why we cover this story. This is why we ask for these documents. This is why it's important.
You finished educating these students. They're ready to go out into the world as journalists. What do you tell them before they go out the door?
I tell them these days you've got to be comfortable being a little uncomfortable when it comes to job security. The good news is it's not that we're sending them into an industry that is financially ruinous and has no hope. My students, by and large, the ones who want to go into journalism, into daily journalism, find jobs very easily and pretty good paying jobs that are involved in daily journalism. And some students want to go to law school and some want to go into book publishing or whatever else. And some people want to go into politics, and that's fine. We teach them the same types of skills, but, you know, mostly we tell them, be ethical, be honest, have integrity, those critical thinking skills, to be skeptical, not cynical. You're going to have to operate on deadline, and there's going to be a lot of stress and a lot of pressure. And, you know, the critics are going to come for you, right? On social media, the trolls are merciless, especially toward women in journalism. And that can be a little traumatizing for some. And so we want to prepare them for what they may face.
Yeah, generally, you don't go into journalism for friendships. And also to your point about, you know, not being cynical. Yeah, I always say that I think journalists are optimists because their whole career is, if I put the effort in, something good may come out of this. And that's an optimistic pursuit, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. We're optimists. We want to help, you know, help the powerless, and we want to hold those in power accountable.
Yeah, I think that's a good place for us to stop. Ted, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Happy to do it. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the people who report the news. You can find out more about us and download past episodes at itsalljournalism.com. While you're visiting our website, sign up for the It's All Journalism newsletter. To make sure you don't miss an episode of It's All Journalism, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Google Play, Amazon, and pretty much anywhere good podcasts are found. If you'd like to help us grow our podcast, like and share our episodes on social media. Look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. It takes a lot of people to create an episode of It's All Journalism. Nicola Grisco is our audio producer. Amber Healy writes our web content. Amia Brust is our booking manager. Steph Thomas manages our social media. Nick Dupre composed our theme music. Carolyn Bilevsky designed our logo. And I'm your host, Michael O'Connell. Thanks for listening.